As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
.755 is real with David O'Brien and Erica Flaherty is on the air now. Welcome to 755 is Real, presented by Topps. Check out Topps Project 70, celebrating 70 years of Topps baseball cards. We missed you. I'm with my co-host, Eric O'Flaherty, former Braves reliever. Eric, what's happening, man?
Not much.
We got a very special guest today, a former teammate of yours. Kelly Johnson's with us, back again. It's been a while. Kelly, what's going on, man? Former Braves legendary, many times former Brave.
Legendary transaction history. Yeah, good, man. Doing good. Just hanging out in Atlanta with the fam.
So Kelly, with the trade deadline coming up not too far away, do you still
PTSD?
I was wondering if you still look at the phone when it rings.
Yeah. No, yeah. Shoot. I leave it on every time. I have the ringer on. I missed one trade with my phone off, because I was taking a nap with, you know, whichever kid was that baby at that time. And I woke up to my wife screaming, "Turn on your phone. We just got traded." I'm like, "What? I'm on the DL. Get out of here. And I'm sucking. Who wants me?"
Well, there's a pretty good chance the trade was either to or from the Braves, right? Which one was
that,
it?
That one was actually from the Yankees to the Red Sox. And we were in Boston. Oh, wow. So I just changed clubhouses. So,
wow. Yeah. Was that the only time you ever did that? Just change clubhouses?
Yeah. Changed clubhouses and traded for one of my good friends, Stephen Drew. We just swapped jerseys. We almost swapped like rental houses. Gear. And
that's great.
Everything. Yeah.
Just families, like that one trade that happened years ago where the two relief pitchers traded families. That actually happened. I'm not making that up.
I know. I've heard that. Yeah. Shoot.
I don't think that could happen today. That wouldn't be frowned upon today.
No, probably not.
Hey, so that was right. That was that time where you played for every AL East team in like a 5 or 6 year span, right?
2 year.
2 year span.
24 month.
Every team in the AL East,
five.
Right?
All five.
That's amazing. Shoot.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I might be infamous just on trivia history. Like in 50 years, they're gonna say who was the first to be traded, you know, playing all AL East, you know, and then you know who was the last person to get traded between the Yankees and the Red Sox. You know, that never happens. I think the last one was back in like 1992 or something. Up until that point, you know, they don't trade with each other.
No,
then the whole Braves Mets. You know, there was like a dude from the Angels that did that a couple times in a row. So yeah, man, it's kind of funny, but that's what
you're
it
right.
is.
Quite a few guys have gone free agency from the Yankees to the Red Sox or back. But you're right. They don't trade with each other.
No, nope. They both sucked that year. So we were, it didn't matter. It was just let's try this and see what happens.
how many NL East teams did you play for?
Braves and Mets.
Oh, yeah. That was it.
No, Frenchie almost got them all.
Yep.
He almost got them all.
He didn't go to DC, right?
Right.
That's right. He played for everybody else. There's somebody else too. I forget.
Yeah, I'm sure. It's happening more and more, but
I think it happens a lot. You know, if you do well in a certain division, even when your numbers are bad.
How many did Prado played for? He played for the Yankees, Marlins, and Braves, right? Didn't he play for the Yankees?
Prado didn't go to D.C. He didn't go to
D.C. Yeah, or the
Philly.
Or the Mets or Philly.
Yeah.
No, he played for, yeah, you're right. He played for the Yankees. Yankees, yeah. Okay. Yeah, I lost my mind there for a minute. Well, let me ask you, Kelly, from afar, from outside looking in, as an interested former Brave, how many times did you play for the Brave, by the way? Three or four? Three different states.
Three.
And a guy who played for the Mets. And I wanted to ask you, I should have looked this up, but I didn't. Did you play with DeGrom or was he right after you?
Yeah. Oh, and I played with him. Yeah. I was with the Yankees on his debut against him in his debut. So I got to see him in his first game was Mets versus Yankees, and I was in the visiting dugout. And then
that was his debut, huh?
Yeah.
Did you face him that day?
Yeah. And I actually remember because he came out with the long hair, you know, and he's all skinny. And we're just you know how it is. Like guys make debuts, you've kind of heard about them. Like you know the name, or you know there's a little hype. Like
there was nothing.
I just showed there was nothing. There was nothing. So when that happens as a hitter, you're basically thinking that they just had to dip down and they needed an arm, and that was just it was like this that guy kinda, turned a pitch.
Yeah.
And then they pitch and they go right back down, and you never see him again. And it used to happen all the time. So in a way, you're kind of thinking like, okay, we got some knocks coming.
Yeah.
And I don't think I started, but I got two ABs on him. And I remember coming in, I struck out and being like, what the hell is this? Like that fastball is on you, you know? And of course you got to see if they can keep doing it, stay healthy. And, you know, then we got to play the next year with them and watch it every day. And I don't know if there's no one better. I've never stood in the box and been more, not, you know, like Halliday's movement was intimidating because you didn't know if it was going in or away, sinking or riding up and in, like cutting. And he made me look pretty stupid a couple times personally, along with everybody, a lot of other people. But just from like a consistently dominant, I've never seen anybody be like Jake, like even from back then. But now, obviously, the numbers back it up. But even back then, it was just consistent. Never got rocked, ever.
No.
Yeah. Yeah, I think he's changed the discussion for most of us on who's the best pitcher of our generation, you know?
The question, he was an old rookie, right? So you got to wonder, you know, how long does he go? But the fact that he's now in his 30s throwing 100.
Getting better. I mean, it's amazing. And we're going to end up looking at his stats, and he's going to be the guy that changes the discussion because his stats are going to be the traditional stats. The wins and losses and all that are going to be so out of kilter with the other great pitchers.
True.
But the first guy that you could look at and say that about, and at the time, I remember as a kid, you look at Nolan Ryan and go, yeah, but he's like 10 and 12. You know, and as a kid, that was important. And now if Nolan Ryan came along now, he'd be kind of Jacob DeGrom-like, and that he was piling up these ridiculous strikeout totals for really bad teams. So he didn't get his due, I don't think, from the general populace when he was playing. He played for a lot of bad teams. But now he would. I mean, Nolan Ryan, people would even more appreciate. In retrospect, they have appreciated how great he was. But Jacob DeGrom is being appreciated while he's doing it, I think, because people understand now how much his wins and losses are dependent upon teams. And
isn't it funny, though? The dude's got back-to-back Cy Youngs, and now we're in – you know, that was – this is like the fourth – year now, and now he's getting buzz. Like he's in New York with two Cy Youngs.
Yep.
And no one even now we're doing profile pieces on this guy.
If he'd have pitched for the Yankees instead of the Mets, it'd have been totally different.
Yeah.
He's taken it to a whole new level this year though. I mean, I think he was that same guy, but this year it's like what he's doing is it's even different than what he was doing in the past.
Well, Eric, you played for the first guy like this who won the Cy Young with a losing record out in Seattle.
I played for him?
No, with Felix. Him.
Oh, Felix. Played with him. Yeah, that's who I was thinking of when Kelly was saying that 10 and 12 and whatnot. Yeah. Felix, he was the same way, though. Like, he was just different coming up. He was throwing 97 with a hammer curveball before everybody was throwing 97. But he popped into my head too, where I was like, that's another guy that if he'd been in a different place,
yep,
and getting those wins or gotten a pitch in the postseason, you know, because in Seattle in general, you're not getting a lot of media hype and attention. But if he'd had his career with the Yankees or somebody else,
he's Hall of Famer.
Felix. Yeah.
Because he's borderline now. I don't think if he gets in, it'll take years. But with the Yankees, I think he goes in pretty quick.
He'd easily have another 50, 60 wins.
Oh, yeah.
Teams that don't rebuild.
And then he's first ballot if he has another 50 wins.
Yeah.
He's first ballot.
He was in the big leagues at 19.
Yeah.
That's pretty amazing.
That's the difference there, you know. He was there, him and Kershaw, like 19, 20. DeGrom was like 26.
Isn't that crazy? Yeah. That's like a whole career. That's like a whole career, basically. I mean, Koufax was great for like that period right there. Yeah. You know, 5 or 6 years, really. I mean, where he traveled the world.
Well, shoot, he was, you know, a college shortstop that pitched, and then so he got put in pro ball, and I just don't think he didn't dominate early. So it kind of they took their time, and then he got the injury. He had I think he had Tommy John or something.
Yeah, I think
some kind of injury that took up a couple years. So they just that's pretty much it. But
you know, he's the only guy. He keeps having these little nagging things, and with other pitchers, when they have one of these nagging things, we're like, Tommy John. He keeps having these little nagging things, and he's back like the next starter. He misses maybe 2 days. He pushes it back, but he keeps it never slows him down. Like he's got one
really
right now.
Good. I think he's really good. I actually saw that, and I think what he's good at is recognizing when to. If I just stop now, I'll be all right.
Right.
And I think some guys, you know, that's what O probably knows, but obviously he knows better than both of us. Like,
I never learned.
What does
that
even feel like, and how do you even tell yourself? Because what happens if you do that and you're not Jacob DeGrom? Then they look at you like
you're always hurt.
You're always hurt, and you need to start powering through this because none of these are leading to any major injury. So you must be soft or something, you know, something like that. But you know, and for Jake, it's more like, oh, he's smart.
Yeah, but he's already gone 5 innings, 12 punches when they take him out of the game.
When you're the greatest pitcher in the game, you can say that, and they'll go, okay. Eric was kind of wrong position, wrong team, wrong time, point in time to be saying, I can't go today.
I know. Well, and it was hard for me too because I always pitched better the more I pitched.
Yeah.
So it I didn't want time off.
Like Moilo. You know?
Yeah, same with Moilo. But it's like if you're rolling, everything's locked in and your elbow hurts a little bit, I'm not sitting out 2 or 3 days. I might get sloppy. You know, you wanna pile up those runs when you can.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, not great for the long term.
No, I didn't know that though at the time.
Do you think Med did that? I haven't asked Med. Did he how much he pitched through? But
his elbow was always bothering him. But he was on that for him. If you're 2012 Chris Medlin and you're on that tear he's on, he's establishing himself as I'm never going back to the minor leagues if I have this run. Or if he says I'm hurt here and he only had 4 or 5 starts in that run that were good, and then he comes back from the DL and he struggles, he's got to make the team next year.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, when you go on a tear like he did, he penciled himself in the rotation the next year, you're getting a raise, the whole thing. So, I mean, that's a tough decision for guys.
I mean, Med, if he had that season that he had then, if he had it now, he might be in a position to get a really big deal, one of those young guys signed long-term and get that security we've talked about, those young guys leaving some on the table for that long-term security. Because he never had that huge contract, and he could have got one with another year like he had.
Yeah.
He was phenomenal year.
Injuries suck. They do. They just change the game, you know, at the wrong time. Timing's everything in that stuff.
Oh, and getting old, man. I was trying to explain to my buddies, I was shooting hoops with a dude that was really good basketball player in high school. And we had barbecue, so we walked over the park by his house and we were shooting hoops. And I was like watching him just struggle to move. He couldn't hit shots. And I was like, that's what it was like the last 2 years of my career, man. I was hitting the same button and just getting a different result. I was firing and doing everything I thought I was doing the same and it just goes away.
Yeah. Kelly, can a guy like you better appreciate when somebody like Acuna takes the money that he did, you know, and leaves potentially, you know, $200 million on the table, but he's got $125 million guaranteed. Can you see both sides of that? A guy who's been through the injuries like you did?
You know, I was fairly lucky injury wise. But that being said, how does he turn out down. I mean, that's almost impossible. That's that kind of money. You know, the ones that are different, I think, are when guys jump on
5 years, 20.
Anything that, anything that's their arbitration years.
Right.
And they go ahead and just lock those down. The team wins all day long. But when the team knows they got somebody special and they're willing to kind of pay them about what they could be in arbitration and make it just, hey, you're our guy. Yeah. So that, I feel like that's what Acuña got. He just,
right.
He was the first one to domino to fall and all these other guys just reaping benefits from that deal. I mean,
right.
If he would have been the second guy, he would have been, we're talking 200 million.
Yeah.
Maybe the third guy, you're talking 300 right. million, like Tatis.
You know, in Tatis's contract, if you look at it close, the real difference comes in the last years of Tatis's contract, because his is what, 14 years or something like that? And Acuña's is 8 with 2 option years. And the real disparity won't happen until the final years of that deal. So yeah. if Acuña were fortunate enough to stay healthy and be great still, he can make that up at the end. But if he falls off, he's not going to. But it's not till the end. Till the
That's
end of the deal.
That's the other thing you think about, though. It's not just health and injuries. It's I was never confident enough to think I'm just going to keep dominating the big leagues. You always think, like, what if I fall on my face? What if I start having bad seasons? You know, and that happens with a lot of guys, too. You see guys come up. Look at Jay Hayes' first year. You know, if he would have signed something based on that, I mean, he wound up getting paid anyway. But you think you're a player that you know, you're going to put up these numbers forever and guys stop performing. You know, that's other risk. And I mean, for him, it's like he's still driving a Lamborghini. You know, I mean, if he doesn't get an extra 100, I don't know that you'd ever feel that. It's like, are you flying private or are you flying normal? You know?
Yeah, he's good. He's good.
He ended up getting lucky, or not getting lucky, but he had that year with the Cardinals where his defense was off the charts. And talk about timing. It was at that time where people were paying on war and defense and looked like this guy's one of the greatest defenders ever and all that. Now the Cubs have regretted it. I mean, they won a World Series with him and he helped out, but he hasn't lived up to that contract, obviously. But he got paid. Yeah. He turned down what Freddie got and ended up getting paid anyway. So
it's weird, though. Like with J.A., you want him on your team. You know, like the way he plays, and I don't know if his defense is still as good as it was when I played with him, but he did something in the field every day, and he'd make a play look so easy it wouldn't go appreciated.
Yeah.
But just being a gamer and having him on your team and being in the clubhouse with him, I was always like, you know, he's just a winner. And so they won a World Series with the contract. I always look at it like if you get a World Series out of one of those deals, it's a good contract.
And whether he contributed a whole lot on the field – they all credit him with that team speech, meeting that he called. So
that speech alone is worth $100 million to Chicago.
You know, and outside looking in, you're like, that's overrated. But that's not what the players say.
What's underrated is the rain delay being even an issue. Like, there's no way that should even happen. You know,
right.
Cubs fans should be less about the speech and more about like the grounds crew or whoever made that decision.
Yeah, you're right.
Let's be honest. I mean, that pretty momentum. Much changed the whole. Oh, it changed everything.
It did.
But whatever, history is history. I would say Acuña, man. You know, you think about some of this, these guys making these deals, and you know, we've played with the guys where it's kind of about money. And once they get the money, the work ethic and the drive changes. And so the guys that are just different, they're not even about the money. Like the money comes and they're just like, I'm playing baseball, and they've got goals that are greater than that. And
that's, you know, Acuña.
Acuña's that guy. If he is that guy, then he's already thinking, like, he's not even thinking next contract. He's just, I'm thinking like legacy. I'm thinking how long I'm going to play till I'm 40 something. And my numbers are going to be huge. And, you know, those guys don't even think about the money.
That's how he strikes me, and everything that I've heard and everybody I've talked to says that about him, that he wants to be the greatest player, that he doesn't. He got the contract. Fine. He hasn't said one word about it since. He didn't tell anybody, even off the record, his friends, after Tatis's contract, you know, oh, shit, what did I do? And instead, he goes and works out in Venezuela in the offseason, posts these videos of him working out. And you talk about we were talking earlier about the rocky fields and everything. That's what he goes back home to in the little town he lives in. It's not in Caracas. It's in a little town up in the mountains. And he worked his ass off on these dinky fields. Dust is flying up everywhere. He's out there working out. He's doing old school drills. And he was busting his ass all off season. There was nothing glamorous about it. He wasn't working out with a bunch of other big leaguers in a nice posh place. He was back home with his family. And he came back to camp this year in far better shape than he was always in good shape, but he had lost about 10 pounds just straight in the gut and ripped. And the speed was even, you know, it was 75 probably last year. It's 80 now.
Yeah, you get the feeling that some of these guys like that, they would play for free, and they're just laughing when people pay them. They're just like, I would do this for nothing, and you're paying me. All right, cool. Like, you look at like Bartolo. Like he was
Bartolo's like, still playing on.
He's like 52, and he's out on those same fields throwing, you know, pitching against like 18-year-olds.
Exactly.
Just because he's just like him striking out a pitch. You see that video of him striking out like a 10-year-old, just front door seeking a 10-year-old.
Yeah, he's just like, let me just play baseball, and if you pay me, great. If not, whatever, I'll go play somewhere else.
Yeah,
that's what those guys do. So that's good to hear. I mean, that's I think that's the difference in like the guys that had the Hall of Fame careers.
Eric, let's hear from today's sponsors.
Looking for an assist with your credit card, but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. With Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into the one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. Get hardware that fits your business. Take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/theathletic, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/theathletic to take your retail business to the next level today. shopify.com/theathletic.
The videos were similar to what you're talking about with Bartolo back home in the little towns, not like living in Beverly.
No. Hold on. Oh, what my kids.
I thought one of us froze up. We can hear you. You're on.
I know. Well, my headphones connected to my iPad that my kids just jumped on. So I'm listening to like Alvin and the Chipmunks.
Well, we can hear you, so.
What is that? I mean, come on.
Rhett, let everybody know how many kids you got, Kelly. I think everybody's probably lost count.
Yeah, four kids, and we're in the summer, and so these guys are all up in my business. Go outside.
Kelly's got four kids, three boys. They're all like all at baseball age, baseball ages.
It's life. I mean, that's what we're saying. It was every weekend right now. It's minimum 10 games. A weekend sitting there watching. I mean, I got the setup, dude. I look like I'm tailgating for, you know, Texas, Oklahoma. I got the tents, I got the fans, I got coolers.
Has East Cobb recruited you yet to coach? Are you a hitting coach with anybody? You're just a parent fan?
Because I coached my middle one the last two years. So he was in like coach pitch. So I'm like out there pitching, just trying to hit their barrels and I couldn't watch my other kids. So I would miss so many games. And, you know, with that many games, like I want to be able to bounce around. And so I love coaching. Like it's fun to go out there, especially when they're pitching.
Yeah.
Like because you're managing a game kind of, even though it's like kids, it's still kind of like some stuff you got to think about. And that part of it's like you just kind of miss. So I wish I was doing that. But
hey, any other players have kids playing with your kids now? A lot of them, right?
You would laugh. You would just. I could give you a list of guys that I've seen at the ballpark. Actually, just recently, Brian Moeller, the scout. He's a scout for the Red Sox. His kid's playing. He's 16 or 15. a guy umpiring walks up to me and he goes, huge dude. He's like, you look really familiar. And I'm just thinking, okay, you know, Braves guy, whatever. He's like, Kelly Johnson? He goes, I'm Alva Thompson. And Alvo used to be a Braves minor league guy back in the lower levels when I was like 19. He played with me in Macon. And the dude would just back up catcher and hit tanks. He'd either hit a tank or strike out. Yeah. He's umpiring my kids' games now. So you got him. I mean, you got John Ennis. Remember John Ennis?
Yeah, yeah.
He was that guy. He was that the Braves needed an arm, and he got called up from AA through five innings, never got to the big leagues again. John Ennis. I mean, Josh Burris, former first rounder, the Braves.
Yeah.
Yep. You see BMAC out there?
Who?
BMAC.
Where's his not kid? Yet. Is his He's kid, younger. His kid's younger, but I DeRosa, see him all the time. We talk all the time and see him out there.
DeRosa's kid up there yet? He's playing that.
Yeah. His kid plays on a travel team where we are.
Did D-Row coach, or he can't do that?
He's going to coach next year, just the game. So he's going to, like, you know, Friday he flies home, and then on the weekend he's going to coach just games. That's the rumor, but
yeah. See, we broke some news here.
Yeah, you did.
So my bad, D.
D-Row's
planning to stay with MLB Network then next year. Not going to take a managing job he's going to manage, but it's going to be a Geese Cobb League.
It's going to be 12U baseball. Remember Contreras, the pitcher from Cuba?
Yeah.
His kid, he's out all the time. Dude, it's crazy. You'll see people and you're just like, Todd Green has like the team in the nation here. His team just whooped up on my kid's team the other day.
Can you tell when you see a big leaguer's kid out there? Or are they just like everybody else?
No, I have Contreras' kid supposedly really good. But everyone else so far is all kind of like middle. Same. Yeah, they're middle. They you know what it is? They all look kind of a little bit like their age versus like some of these kids look like they're 13 or 14. And so most of these kids, like Todd Green's kid, my kid, they're still a little baby fat on them. They look like a little boy. Like they don't look like some, you know, teenager.
Were you, when you were playing growing up, were you heads and shoulders above all the other kids or just like them?
Well, so we didn't have travel. Remember, we didn't do the travel thing. It didn't exist. So you're just playing against your friends from school, man. So yeah, like from like 6 till 12 you're killing it. You know, like you're playing against buddies and you're going to school bragging. You're like, you know, I struck you out or hit a you know, like that was baseball. That was it. That was what it was all about, you know? But then once travel started, like 12, 13, I would say I would have big moments and then kind of – and you know, there were some kids that were always really good, never did anything after that, you know. And I just had good timing. Like I think I took off and started dominating like right before my senior year of high school. So, I mean, you know.
You had that 12-year-old kid with a huge curveball, but he never got any better than that.
We were talking about that before we started, Dave, how it's like, I was just a normal kid all the way up through like till my junior year in high school. And the amount of just the way parents weigh this stuff, like if you have the best 10-year-old or 11-year-old, they think their kid's going to the big league. Just the pressure that they wind up putting on their kids and how competitive parents are. It's like Kelly's just preparing me for, you know, what to be ready for with my own son. He said that, you know, there'll be a target on his back and everybody will kind of want to see how they stack up to your son and things like that. And I'm like, man, I'm not looking forward to that because I never had any of that growing up. We just played.
On your end, what it's going to be because for me, it's like if my kids aren't good hitters, then if I bring anything to a practice and I'm like, you know, I'm going to work with hitters just to help out. Part of it is almost like, well, what do you know? Your kid's not that good.
Yeah,
he's not hitting. So, like, if your kid's not pitching well, what do you know? Your own kid doesn't even pitch well. You know, what do you know?
He's seven.
That's what it is. That's how they look at it. Like, baseball is that one sport where, you know, whoever they're sitting there, they watch 120 Braves games on TV.
Yeah,
every year. Because of that, they know the game. I watch all these games. I know just as much. And you're like, man, everything's very reactive in youth baseball. The coaches don't prep them. They're not setting up what is going to happen. And they just yell at them after it happens, and then that's their coaching. Like, so next time you got to do this because you didn't do it. Whereas they could have been like, hey, you know, let's be here, there, let's line up this or this guy, you know, whatever it is, you know, a little proactive, a little bit of like foresight because you know the game.
So that even goes with former players, huh? Some who watch the game on TV think that they know more about it than you do or as much as you do.
Then what do you mean?
Watching like, on TV, they think they know as much about it as you do and about the.
Yeah, no. Like, I had a guy tell me this one time.
I believe it.
He said you could be Chipper Jones or Bobby Cox, and if you come into a youth baseball environment, you don't know nothing. This is a different game. This is a different kind of a game. Man, there's the rules. You got to know the rules. Umpires are butchering stuff, and coaches are making stuff up, and the umpires believe them and.
Yeah.
It's silly, man. It's silly. You see some stuff you wouldn't believe. It's fun, but it's silly.
Hey, look, real quick here, we got some ads. Cam, you want to make some money for us here, real fast?
Let's roll.
Yeah, and I just realized I didn't welcome in us with the 755 is real presented by Topps thing. Did I mess that up? I can
add
read
it in
that
later.
I can read that later. We could add it or. All right. So let's real quick. Let's talk. I want to ask you about the Braves, Kelly. I meant to ask that earlier and we got sidetracked there. From an outside looking in, watching them this year. I mean, I know they haven't had a season like this in a while where they struggled for a while. Are you like Eric, though, when you say there's still 99 games to play? There's plenty of time for this. I mean, they're only 5 games back. I mean, we keep right. It feels like they're 20 games back, but they're 5 games back. And we saw a Braves team blow a double-digit lead in September before, not that long ago. So we know it can happen, and that's 4 months to make up 5 games, basically, or 3.5 months.
Yeah, no, it's – there's so much time left. And, you know, when I was younger, Teixeira came over, and he said it. Then back in like 2007, he was like, for 100 games, everybody's the same. Mm-hmm. There's always like that one team that's just can't win. They suck. They're done. And there's always one team that's just built such a big lead. There's always an anomaly, but he's like the rest, like 98% of the season, everybody's playing 500 baseball, 100 games. It's the last 60 that make or break it, you know, and that feels like it held true for the past, you know, whatever, 14, however many years it's been. I think there's plenty of time. The division is talented, but they're not. It's talented, but it's kind of the weak, one of the weakest divisions.
Yeah, nobody's running away with it at all.
Tons of talent, you know. So the Braves, you know, my thing with them is that the pitching has always been one of those things that I've looked at. Even when they've been winning these last 2 years, I felt like they've been getting away with something the last couple of years.
Uh-huh.
So this year feels like it's like kind of coming back.
Evening out.
Mm-hmm. Evening out. You know, but the offense around the league is down. All these guys I see at these tournaments that are scouts and they watch all these games and scout all these games, they keep telling me how bad the game is. It's in bad shape just from an offensive standpoint. You know, some pitchers would say even from a pitching standpoint, despite the velocity and stuff being up. So it's a weird season, but the coming off that COVID year, you know, it's going to feel like a long season for these guys for sure. So it's just a different year, but
yeah,
Braves have the talent. It's just they need some people to start being like carrying it.
Yeah,
yeah. Well,
you've seen enough of Freddie Freeman and played with him are you confident that at the end of the year his numbers are going to be pretty close to what they always are?
You know what I'm confident in? I'm not going to sit here and say, oh, at the end of the year the guy's going to be whatever. What's his career batting average? Is
about probably 285 or 290. Yeah,
I'm not going to sit here and say that he's hitting 220 and he's going to end at 285.
Mm-hmm.
He's probably going to finish somewhere in the middle of that.
Mm-hmm.
What I am confident in saying is that when Freddie Freeman comes up at some point in a stretch,
right?
Yeah,
a couple months, when he comes up to the plate and we need him, he's going to be Freddie Freeman.
Yep.
So he might go 0-for-3 for the first 3 at bats of a game, but he comes up with that 4th at bat and you need him to be Freddie Freeman. I'm confident he's going to be Freddie Freeman. That makes sense.
Yeah, and Chipper told him, you know, hey, I hit 235 one year. Chipper was being nice, trying to make him feel good. Chipper hit 249, I think he was talking about in his worst year, but he also hit 30 bombs that year. But Chipper was making a point that it was in the middle of a stretch where Chipper otherwise hit 300 every year and like 3 years later won the batting title at 364. So lifetime average, even with this year, it's 292. 381 OBP, career slug. He's at 461 right now. And 889 career OPS. He's at 815 right now.
Yeah, well, let's ask Eric if he's navigating through the lineup.
Nope, I don't want any part of Freddie. I don't care if he's hitting 127. Yep. I don't want that at bat.
And you know what? Braves teammates sitting in the dugout, Freddie Freeman in the lineup versus not in the lineup, Chipper they Jones in the lineup versus not in the lineup, game changer. Doesn't matter.
Yeah.
So, you know, especially from like Eric's perspective of being a pitcher, like when he's there and he's coming up and you're thinking ahead a couple hitters and you're like, Freeman's coming up.
Yeah.
Yeah, you want to get it done before you get to him, even if he's struggling, because you know the type of a bat he's going to have. You know what he can do. You know, even watching him this year, I mean, he's had some bad luck. He's hitting balls hard still.
Oh, yeah. He's still like fourth in the league in hard hit balls.
Which sucks, because you'd rather be like 35th in the league in hard hit balls and hitting 297.
That's what he said.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, as a player and even as an opponent, you know how to analyze it, you know, apart from the numbers, and just say I can say at some point those balls are going to start falling in, or he's going to start getting some bloopers. He might.
And he caught a couple of those in this trip too.
His swing might be locked in right now, and he might feel off and start dropping bloops in. You know, I mean, the hard thing is it's such a hard season, and if he did this in the middle of the year, got into this little rut, it wouldn't be a big deal. But anytime you start off a year like that, like, it's just more emphasis on it and the spotlight's on it, and it's, is this your bad year? Are you struggling? But
especially when a guy like Ozuna's out, is not doing, he's gone now, but when he was struggling and Albies was struggling at the time, it was just about everybody except Acuna was. So Freddie's thing is more magnified than
they're just in this little, offensively, it just feels like they're in this little thing where they've got guys get hot and they're kind of spread out. You know, it's like,
That's what we were saying.
Riley or Raken, but you know, Acuna and Freddie won't be, and then Acuna will be, and you know what I'm saying? Like, it's like we're not seeing what we've seen the last few years, where the train just lets man up, and they just rolled through. You know, it was a deep lineup, and guys were feeding off each other. We're not seeing that. We're seeing kind of the typical middle of the road offense, where you know, one guy is hot, one guy's not, and that big moment in the game falls on the guy that's not, more times than not.
You're like, Well, last year they had six, seven guys going at once. It was only a 60-game season, and they had six or seven guys going for the majority of time. This year, in April and into May, they had Acuna, and then one other guy would be going at any given time. And then Riley got hot, and Acuna cooled off a little bit. Nazi got hot. But that's been about it. They've had maybe three to four. Dansby Swanson got hot, but they've never had more than that. And for about a month and a half, it was basically one guy, then one other guy. So it's only now they're really starting to put together the whole offense. And Freddie is, you know, still just for him, not doing much. So, but
as a fan looking, what do you got? Sorry.
Well, you were talking about Freddie Freeman, how pitchers. Obviously you don't want, there's going to be one guy you focused on not letting beat you. And Freddie Freeman's going to be that guy still, him and Acuna, obviously now. But how much harder do you think, how much more of an advantage is it for Acuna, and it makes it that much tougher for teams to zero in on when he's leading off? I think coming up, that's a different state of mind, right? As a pitcher, when that's the guy starting a game, and he's shown it so many times that they throw a first pitch strike and boom, he hits it out. So it brings a whole different dynamic to it.
Yeah. You can't pitch around.
You can't put him on. Yeah. You can't put him on to start the game.
No. He's a freak, and he's special, and he'd do what he's doing wherever in the lineup.
Anywhere. He could hit anywhere. One through five.
One thing that's great about being able to lead him off is that you don't pitch around a leadoff guy ever. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not going to happen. And especially when you got Freeman behind him, but he's Freeman, whether he's the spot behind him or two spots behind him, You're not ever going to just give in and just pitch around to Acuna. You're just not, unless you're in the playoffs and then you've got the matchup and you've got a guy that, you know, you feel better about against Freeman versus
lefty with an open base.
Yeah. So playoffs, you know, things change. That's the beautiful thing about baseball, is playoff baseball is the best, but he's going to get his all day.
No matter what. That's why I tell Dave all the time, when we talk about his leadoff stats, I'm like, well, you know, part of the reason he's hitting so many leadoff homers because he should be in the four hole. Yeah. I mean, he's that powerful of a hitter, but he just, for whatever reason, functions leading off really well, and they don't want to mess with it.
Yeah. What he, he has Acuna has the what was that? I was thinking of you made me forget. He has that. He comes up there with that first pitch. He's the anti-Prado. We were talking about this last week. How Prado never swung at the first pitch. A year in, year out, he was always first, second in the league, and not in lowest percentage swinging at first pitch. What was yours? I remember you were.
Yeah, I had a little bit of like I was a schizophrenic of a career with that stuff.
Yeah, you changed myself, it.
When I was trusting myself early, I knew I needed to work into an at bat. I was better. I was better in pitch four or five or six than I would be one or two. And I learned real quick. I really needed to be patient and see a pitch and get the timing and everything going with my at bat.
Yeah,
I'll be honest. Not blaming anybody other than myself, but Bobby made a few comments here and there about being too patient.
And
he's,
to us, he made those.
And so I started feeling every once in a while like, okay, maybe I do need to start being ready and being ready to hit.
Yeah.
Because, if I was going to strike out looking, it's because I was not swinging at a pitch that wasn't mine, and I could take it. I would be okay with it, in my own head. But when I started to feel like there was some, hey, like you got to get more aggressive. You got to start doing, I let it get to me a little bit. So I definitely had a moment there where I think I was on the right track early. I think I deviated and then I got back to it. And then the game got, like O said, you get older and things change. You start having as a hitter, I couldn't just react on 95 anymore and expect to drive it. Now I'm having to really
almost cheat.
Yes. And cheat. Know like, okay, I'm getting a heater and I'm timing it. And you know what? At the end of my career, I don't know that I ever went to the plate more often, more confident as when I was older, just from that aspect of being able to understand like what the guy was trying to do, what he had, what my limitations were. So even though, I didn't have the physical reaction of a 25-year-old, like that's why I think I had success pinch hitting at the end of my career, obviously. Mm-hmm. Like, you come in like, and you know what you're doing, but
like Sandoval.
Yeah, it's such a cliche, but literally if you could go back in time and be that smart when you had the physical,
you hit 340.
You'd be Chipper Jones.
Well, that's what these guys that are the young stars are doing now. They're well trained and well taught and well coached, and they know they're willing to listen. Like I was stubborn, I know what works for me, So I mean, that's the difference between guys that are perennial all-stars and guys not like me that I had a career and it was my career, but it wasn't like an all-star career.
Right.
That's just the difference if we're being real. So,
but that's the difference in some guys like you, but like Sandoval was an all-star, but how he keeps playing when physically you look at Sandoval and you go, there's no reason that guy should be able to play Major League Baseball at this level, but he's so smart and he knows pitchers and he prepares so much and he's still got plenty of bat speed.
Yeah, I don't know. That's a hard one for me to, because my career maybe ended a little a year or two earlier than it should have, I think, just because the way that the front offices started valuing or devaluing older guys.
Right. Right.
I feel like a lot of guys they're way more valuable than I think is being let on. I think I personally was more valuable at the end of my career doing what I was doing than what I was told I was.
Yeah.
And that was just a movement that we've seen go younger. And I'll just, now that it's been 5 years, there's a statute of limitations on opinions, I think. So like I could have been back with the Braves a fourth year. There was a lot of talks in the off season before I retired. And that was one of those situations where I was like, I'm coming back to Atlanta or I'm done. And so I had a lot of talks with Copy and we were good to go for a while. And then all of a sudden it was, we're going to stick with Chase Darnold. And I remember as soon as I got that feeling, I was like, Copy, like you're basically telling me that Chase Darnold's a better player than me. And I can't disagree with you more. Like that's absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah.
But Chase could play short. They could throw him in center if they needed to. So from that, like I understood. And I mean, he's a freak athlete, but as a baseball player, come on.
Yeah.
And this was coming off of a year I just tied for the lead in pinch hit homers and had a lot of big hits with, at the end of the year. Anyway. That's what I felt like ended my career with that mentality. And so when I see Sandoval, I'm not surprised. The dude raped, his whole life. Yeah. Now he's made a conscious effort to like say, like, I know my role.
Yeah.
And this is how I prepare for that role. It's a different preparation.
And what you're saying, the only reason Sandoval's had this opportunity is the Braves cut payroll and he was cheap and they invited a bunch of guys to spring training and he was on a non-roster invitee. They had no intentions of carrying him. And he had 400 in spring training and guys that they brought in, a couple on major league contracts for like $1 million, looked like crap in spring training. And he beat them out. Younger guys. So they kept him, not thinking he was going to hit any home runs. So this kind of an accident in some way, what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Well, you could have done that. You could have done that.
No, so that was an option. I had several major league deal that I wasn't willing to accept. And that's my point. Like the value, them not valuing to say that this guy's worth a guaranteed spot, I think it's crap. I think it's obvious. And then when you see those things happen, which they happen more often than not, you're like, you're telling me you can't give that guy $1 million to be on your bench and provide what he provides, and you're going to go with a cheap option and rotate, you know, a bench spot. And none of these guys are playing in the minor leagues for longer than a couple years anymore. Like, that's where I think some of these guys, those scouts, are saying the game is not good, is not in good shape right now.
Yep.
We're getting these guys with, back in the day, it was 1,500, 2,000 plate appearances. I don't know what the innings. They'd like to see guys get innings in the minor leagues before they got up. Typically, there's a number in their head for plate appearances. It's like 1,500 or 2,000.
Yeah,
that ain't happening anymore.
No, now they just want to see the big stuff. Learning.
And that, as a clubhouse in the locker room, that's a nightmare. Because I'm telling you right now, you're not learning how to be a teammate and how the things work in the minor leagues. So now you get to the big leagues, and they got their feet kicked up in the clubhouse. They're on their phones during the game. You know, they're not even acting like professionals. So it's sad in that way that so many baseball guys are kind of being shown the door.
Yeah.
And
kudos
to Sandoval and guys that do say, you know what, again, I don't need the money. I just want to play ball. You know, Adam Jones, he's out there in Japan. You know, Horacio Ramirez, he's still pitching. Peter Moylan. Peter Moylan's still basically staying hot because they want to play international. So, I mean – awesome. Yeah. That's an awesome thing. And that's a great thing. I do think some of these guys deserve the guarantee, though.
And Sandoval has been so critical in that clubhouse, too. I mean, they lost leaders like Markakis, man.
Three-time World Series champion.
Yeah.
You think he doesn't know how to win games?
And he could just as easily have been in the situation you're talking about, though, if he wasn't willing to accept the minor league deal from the Braves, go to spring training and rake hit 400 and basically make it impossible not to keep him. But it's almost by accident that he's on this team. I mean, he could easily be out of the game right now this year or playing in the minors somewhere trying to earn a spot with the team. And instead, he's the best pinch hitter in baseball this year so far. So
love it. I love it for him.
Yeah.
I always talk about, you know, because that's another thing when you're talking about just the things you learn over years and years. I always talk about how, you know, a veteran player can just have one thing they say to you that clicks. Or they can break something down for you in a different way. You know, like even for me, I was telling Dave a few episodes back that Rick Ankiel gave me a tip on my curveball or on my slider, something that he used on his curveball. But I rode that for like 6 months one year. I rode it from like spring training all the way until August. And I was hot with this one thing that Rick said to me about shortening up my arm action on my slider. And I think that's one thing that, you know, kind of gets out of the game when you don't have guys that have been around and been through it and learn how to get out of those ruts. It's impossible to value, but who was it? Tomlin was helping a guy a lot last year.
Mentor.
Mentor.
Changed his career.
Yeah. I think it's a shame that a guy, you know, late in his career, that's not valued what young guys can pick up from older dudes, but it isn't. I mean, you know, you wind up just taking the guy that's faster and more athletic and sending you home, you know.
And Hamels with Fried last year was a huge part in Fried's turnaround.
Yeah.
But Mentor credits Tomlin for saving his career, man.
Well, and then basically, not to mention, you know, we're not even keeping these guys in the mix as field staff. Now we've got guys that, you know, that don't – I've heard from numerous people that there's a lot of organizations that have pitching machine BP. Because the coaches aren't baseball guys. They can't throw BP.
Yeah.
Having that game life experience, like O said, like invaluable, man. I'll tell you right now, I wasn't ever when I left the 2014 Yankees, Boston, Baltimore, that was pretty much when my career went from starter to bench guy. And so the next year I was a minor league guy and came back with the Braves and made the team. And that team had Johnny Gomes, and Gomes had been at least a platoon guy his whole career. So he might have everyday type at bats as a platoon guy, but he was also a bench guy. So he said the greatest thing ever for me that I didn't even cross my mind on how to prepare for being a bench guy. He's like, when you know that your spot or a spot for you is coming up, you need a good sweat. He's like, you go run. Cause I would just do the standard, like two jogs, stretch, swing. And that was it. But I wasn't hot.
Need a lather.
So I took that and started, like, my sprints got harder, or I jump on a bike and pedal a little faster, and I would get a sweat. Changed everything for
yeah.
me. Just something like that. Yeah. That's what I'm talking about. And it's like a guy that's, his career was based on that, handing it down. And I handed it down to people in the Mets. Brandon Nimmo was one of those guys. Those things, you're not going to get that from a guy that didn't play.
Yeah.
Anyway. Sound like the old grumpy guy now yelling at clouds, but you know.
No, there's a lot of value in knowing what it feels like, you know, knowing what it's like to have gone through it. You know, I don't hate analytics or any, you know, I think there's a lot of value in a lot of the other stuff you see too. If every time you see a line drive up the middle and there's a dude just standing on second base catching it, like you can't argue the value in a lot of this stuff. But I do think it's a shame that there's so many coaches and good baseball people just being shown the door, and that little stuff like that's not going to get passed down.
Guys, let's take a quick break and then we'll finish up the show. There's a couple of organizations. I know the Astros, the Braves bullpen coach now, who they hired away from the Astros back in December when they got rid of their 59-year-old bullpen coach, because this guy's really heavily into analytics and has the whole thing is able to, the theory being that he could take the analytics and apply them better to the pitching staff, because you've got kind of a traditional pitching coach in Granitz. But the Astros, he was one of the coaches the Astros hired away from being a college coach, analytics guy, who didn't play, you know, didn't come close to playing even high minors, much less major league ball, and really has background more in analytics. And some teams are hiring coaches like in their 30s who never got up even close to playing in the big leagues. Some of them didn't even play minor league ball, just stopped in college. In fact, he didn't even play minor league ball. He played at a small college and was a middle-in reliever, and he's the bullpen coach now, you know, but he's heavily into analytics. But that's just you know, kind of the direction that some organizations are going. They're hiring young guys.
What it reminds me of is when I got to the Diamondbacks, when I left the Braves the first time, it was, you know, the Braves had a guy, you might know his name. Is it Llewellyn, who was like like a sports psychologist kind of a guy?
Yeah,
he was around, but not much, but he was around, and I never knew that like I could go talk to him if I needed to or wanted to. But the Diamondbacks had that guy, and he was very much around and very much like, this is what he does. Talk to him like you should. And that's become more popular, right?
Performance coach.
Performance, sports psych.
Yeah. Anyway. Those guys had nothing for me.
Yeah. So this is what's great. So this guy's from like Britain or something. And he works with a lot of golfers.
Yeah.
And he's always talking. He's got the answers for everything. You know, like, why are you pissed? You know, like you shouldn't be dragging that stuff around. All of it's true, but it's like, okay, man. And he's working with golfers. So these guys on this Diamondbacks team, like Chris Snyder and some other, Dan Heron, I think, they took him golfing. They said within like two holes, he hit a bad fell shot apart. And that club is flying. Like, dude, yeah, tell me more about how I should go and stand up on the mound and not get pissed when I walk the third guy in a row or make an error and then strike out. Tell me more about that when you've never done it in your life.
Well, that's the thing about the bullpen, man, is like the bullpen is for me, the best coaches are guys that help you handle that pressure. When it's the fifth inning and you know you're going to be in the sixth or seventh, you're going to be facing that guy. The guys that still know how to keep it loose and you know, hammer home that message that it's the same game if it's bases loaded or nobody on. you know, I mean, there's just so much value in having been through it and knowing how to handle that pressure and the things you can pass on to guys.
So you don't think the analytics guy who played small college ball and started
coaching? Well, there's a place just, for that guy.
There is. I don't think he knows what's really going through your head and how to control that.
Yeah. You need both those guys.
You need people that know how to have a bridge or something.
Yeah.
You got to manage your emotions. You got to manage yourself, and you got to know how to take pressure off yourself before you go out there. You know, it's great if you tell me what pitch to throw. You know, the best pitch to throw here is a fastball down and away, but how do I make it when I can't feel the ball in my hand? How do I calm myself down? That type of stuff.
And I think the Braves have done a real good job having a coaching staff that is old school guys who are all willing to embrace the analytics and be the bridge you're talking about. Ron Washington giving you the analytics on why you should position here is a lot better than the analytics guy coming from the room and showing you the printouts going, this is why you should be here. And he never played the game.
Yeah. And for people listening, a lot of teams have that. A lot of teams, like Sam Fultz, the GM of the Phillies, that was his job with the Phillies before he got promoted. So teams have the bridge, the guy that played that can, you know. So there's some people that are actively trying to manage that. You know, they'll figure it out eventually. The old school guys will be, you know, slide back into roles that, you know, are customary, and there will be a place for both, I'm sure, but. You know, it's whatever that quote is about being the man in the arena. Like, to me, that's one of those. Like, I don't want to hear it if you haven't stood there and done it, you know. And even from baseball, sometimes the best coaches didn't necessarily, you know, Snit didn't play in the big leagues, but his strength isn't the experience of standing in the box or catching.
Absolutely.
His strength is keeping it fun, keeping it light, having a good, steady, calm personality.
Understanding.
A communicator. You know, they have their strengths there that some of the best coaches I've had did not have. I had a coaching staff in Arizona that had like five dudes that won MVPs, All-Star Games, and World Series. You know, a couple of them great. A couple of them I didn't get much from. You know, so sometimes the best players don't make the best coaches. So I'm not going to sit here and I don't want that to be what people hear. But, you know, you have to have something like that.
And if you're not one of the best players, because a lot of the best managers have been pretty bad, or not bad players, but players that never made it past like AA, AAA, you know, and a lot of the greatest players, there's very few of them have made great managers. There's not many Frank Robinsons and, you know, Lou Piniella's who was real good. There's a lot more players that were mediocre, like the Snickers or whatever. Most of them got to the big leagues or whatever. But Snickers, what we've talked about, the Snickers' biggest strength is he has said numerous times, he says it all the time, he understands how hard this game is to play because he wasn't very good himself. So he fully appreciates how hard it is to play.
Yeah.
And he doesn't try, like you said, he's a manager and he surrounds himself with guys who were good players and know how to teach the game. And he's kind of the communicator, but he surrounds himself and delegates those duties. That's if he tried to be a micromanager, he wouldn't be nearly as effective a manager as he is. He doesn't try to be something he's not, you know?
And it doesn't mean he can't look out there and see from a scouting perspective.
Right.
Or he's seen so much baseball. It's like Bobby.
Yeah.
Bobby basically played a year and a half in the big leagues.
Right.
You know, but man, he grew up in an organization with some players and he's seen a thing or two.
Right.
After a while, you know, you just got to say, man, like, what has he not seen?
Right.
You know, and that's a lot of those. Showalter, you know, some of the best managers I played for, Bobby and Showalter, you know, Hinch had a decent backup career. Joe Girardi, backup catcher also.
A lot of backup catchers and a lot of catchers make great managers.
Catchers are good ones.
We've talked about this. It's kind of like that's the only position where you actually literally see the entire game unfold because it's in front of you.
And – I mean, they communicate with the bullpen their whole life. They're
pitchers,
trying. I mean, a good catcher will tell you. And Bobby, I mean, David and Rossi and BMAC both have said it 1,000 times. Their job, first and foremost, is to make the pitchers look good.
Right.
You know, that is it. You know, and Brian was a silver slugger and raked, but I promise you, he lived and died by what he did as a game caller and helping the pitchers and whatnot. And if it didn't go well, he put it on himself.
Yeah.
So. You know,
I tell Dave that all the time. Like, you know, we'd be having a few beers after the game or something, and BMAC could have been 3 for 4. Rossi had a good game hitting. And these guys would be pissed off that they called the wrong pitch on the changeup or something in a 7-0 game, and Christian Martinez wound up giving up a run. You know, they'd be going back and forth over that pitch they called, and that would ruin their day.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I was always shocked by that. I'm like, man, you hit two homers today, and you're worried about one pitch you called in the sixth inning that didn't have any effect on the game.
Yeah.
It's really amazing. You see how many, if you go back through the list of great managers, how many of them were catchers? I mean, I covered a couple of years. Jim Leland, you know, was a mediocre catcher in the minor leagues and just made a great manager. But I mean, there's so many of them. If you look, you're like, well, he was a catcher too. Yeah. So, there's something too, the communication, knowing the whole game, understanding the whole game. And then a lot of great players, they can't, a lot of great players like Ted Williams, that was a crappy manager very briefly. Because they can't really relate to an average player, you know?
They could just do things other people couldn't. Yeah. And they're like, well, why don't you just get your foot down earlier? That's what I did. You know, trying.
Oh, I had Don Baylor in Arizona. And I'm like, Chipper, you know, loved Don Baylor. And I'm like, perfect. This is going to be awesome. You know, finally, this guy's going to be great. Chipper loved him. Well, Baylor, it was so simple for him.
Yeah.
And he kept telling me, it's just this, baby. Like, you got your dominant. It's just this. And I'm like, first of all, you're a right-handed hitter. I'm a left-handed hitter. And you're telling – I could not relate to the guy whatsoever. But the guy I have the year before, his name is Jack Howell. He was a pinch hit bench guy for, I don't know, maybe he got like close to 10 years. But he's just a goofball who just made it like fun and didn't put any pressure on us. And he was always there for the, you know, at the right time in the batting cage. You needed him. You needed the field. He had it ready. And he just make you feel really less crappy about a bad stretch. And that was
perfect
for me.
And some guys just click with some guys, and there's really not much of an explanation for it either. I mean, like Austin Riley, the Braves have four hitting coaches right now. When you include Chipper now, as a part-time, he's here for home games and all that. They have four hitting coaches now because they had they promoted Magallanes last year. Everybody swears by Magallanes from AAA came up. Seitz has coached some great hitters in his time. Kansas City, Toronto here. Seitz was a hell of a hitter himself. The Yankees was a hell of a hitter himself through his career. And then Austin Riley, during this stretch he had a bit of a rough patch in this for the first time in a while during this road trip, four games hitless. So who does he turn to? The guy that got his swing right when he was in the minor leagues when he first got promoted up here, Mike Brumley. He just clicks with Mike Brumley, who's the minor league hitting coordinator. So they got four hitting coaches here, but he texts back and forth with Mike Brumley, who saw something in his swing, his elbow. He was talking about his elbow, and he was either getting high, too high, it was coming around the ball, or it's too low. But Brumley texted him this. He worked on it in the cage yesterday. He goes out and has three hits, a hit by pitch, a walk, a home run, three RBIs. Just after making an adjustment with the guy who's not even with the team. He's the minor league hitting coordinator. So sometimes there's really not – some guys click better with some guys, like Baylor with Chipper. Chipper said Baylor turned his career around.
Yeah, I know. It's hilarious. It's just the way it goes. But I don't know. But, you know, as far as like, you know, we were talking about just the strength of the experience and the guys. I mean, I joked about my transaction history being what it is. And that could be what, you know, if anybody remembers the name Kelly, they're going to remember some stupid trade, you know, transaction, you know, whatever. Being remembered for something is great. So, but I got to play for a lot of great organizations. I made a list like 2 years ago of all the guys I played with at each position. And it's just Hall of Famers. Yeah. Managers, Hall of Famers, pitchers. And I mean, I was enough of a teammate to have some kind of little relationship with most of these people. And that's in here. Like, you know, I can carry that around. And there's guys like that that are way put my list to shame.
Yeah.
And those guys need to be in the game. They need to be, that's where you learn it. You know, somebody says, well, you know, Chipper, we listened to a broadcast and Chipper said this about your hands with hitting. Well, that's not, I guarantee you, that's not Chipper saying that. That's Chipper getting it from Billy Cargill.
Right.
Yeah.
Don Baylor. And he got it from somebody. Yeah. He got it. This is passed down. And that's, I often like have to tell people like where I, like, even dads of kids, I'm like, you know, so-and-so told me, and then their ears perk up. Like,
yeah. Right. Yeah.
You know, I have to drop the biggest name possible to get.
Yeah.
To get the reaction, but it's like, no, man, like this is what it is to have had a career and a life in this game. That's why being somebody that's played this long and having guys on your bench or in your locker room that have have been around that long matters.
D-Row has done a great job of exploiting just what you're talking about, using it in the right way on his show on Central.
Right.
Because he'll talk about some pointer, and he doesn't just say it. He says, when I talk to Chipper, when I talk to the guys he played with in Texas, he cites every guy that told him this, and it makes it, okay, you listen. You listen a little more closely than if he was just making this up himself or some observation he had.
Yeah. I just videoed Jim Tomei giving a tutorial on keeping the hands above the baseball.
He's great.
I recorded it. And I got three boys, and I'm dad. I'm not a baseball player. I'm dad. So then I'm like, here, watch this. And it was like, I think I may have said everything he said word for word with the exact same demonstration.
Right.
And my kids are like, oh, yeah. You know?
Yeah. They're like, he has 600 home runs. It matters coming from him.
The context of, like, where did you get it? Where did it come from? And how long it's been passed around? Like, those things are invaluable. So to not have somebody and people in your organization around, like, it's baffling. I do think it's coming back around. But it's been crazy. And then you're starting to see, especially the hitting has been, I mean, I'm sure the pitching too. Like, these guys aren't dotting up. They're not dialing back to make, you know, extend their games. They're throwing as hard as they can for as long as they can, and then they're out.
Yeah, yeah.
And you get these hitters, like I was watching a game. I don't even know who the hitter was, but, you know, we get into any highlight where they show a pitcher striking a guy out. Let's, you know, I'm seeing two strike home run slopes.
Yeah.
No cut down, no choke. And I'm not like this huge spread out and choke up guy. I would never teach that or tell anyone, but at the same time, like,
game's on the line, you know, shorten up and let's make contact here.
And you have to work on it. You have to have situational BP, and there's got to be that moment where your brain puts yourself in that, like, position, like, you know, how – anyway.
What do you think about the shift? Like, the guys – because me and Dave talk about this a lot, and it's like, the you know, the whole go the other way thing, and the two arguments is, you know, one, hitters – or one side will say, you know, hitters are stupid. They need to shorten up and go the way like it's easy. And the hitters will say, well, I'm facing 100 with a 95 mile an hour slider. You know, it's not easy to hit. So as a hitter, what do you?
Yeah. You know, like, I feel like as a hitter, again, being able to have the correct middle approach and then being able to, like, you know, anytime you start trying to manipulate anything, you're going to put yourself in a tough spot. And so I do think you need to stay true to what you can do, but what you can do needs to be taught and worked on. And it needs to be, you know, be something that can be counter to the shifts. So by staying more middle, not necessarily like zapping your power and trying to massage things the other way, now you're like missing pitches you should crush because you're doing this. But I was watching, I had a dig me moment of all my like 2005, 2007 highlights, and I hadn't pulled those discs out in forever. And I had my son watching them, and we're just sitting there. And I mean, it was like, roll over ground ball down the line for a double, roll over four hole, no shifting. And I'm just boom, hit, rolling over. And I'm like, dang, 5 years later, every one of those is an out.
That's kind of what we were talking about. You know, it's like you see all the no hitters and all this stuff. Like, I think it's definitely harder to hit now with those defenses. But I mean, I'm guessing, like, do you think guys could adjust, or is it just like Daniel Murphy said it however many years ago? He's like, if I hit a single, I'm going to clog the bases up. If I try to hit my doubles and homers, you know, I'm going to put up my numbers. But I just wonder what you think about that mindset.
Yeah, I agree. No, I think what Murph and what Kevin Long were on to was they're shifting you. And so we got to do something a little different. And that's where Murph, the funny thing is that was the beginning of the launch angle. And some might point to like them.
Murph's not launching.
Murph, actually, if you ask him, the only thing he did, he stopped trying to massage the ball the other way. He started trying to drive it. But then we're taught from a young age in our generation, inside on top of the ball. So pick a spot up on top of the ball, inside, and stay through it. And he said, I'm not looking at the top inside anymore. I'm looking at the bottom of the baseball, and it's the same swing. So now he's taking the same swing at the bottom of the ball, and he's hitting
it in the air.
And so he's just trying to drive it, same approach, middle of the field, gap to gap, but instead of staying on top inside of the baseball, he's staying on the bottom of the baseball. All of a sudden, and people don't understand, Murph, if you watch him in the cage, more, he has as much pop. It's like Ichiro in the cage.
He won the home run derby if he felt like it.
So it didn't surprise me one bit when Murph starts hitting all these tanks, because I had seen him in the cage and the ball's exploding. off his bat more than guys like David Wright, and, you know, even more so than some of those guys. And you're like, you should have been doing this your whole life, but he didn't.
I faced him in 09 and 10, and he was just slapping balls all over the place. And then 5 years later, he decided to start trying to hit it in the air, and he was dropping tanks.
Well, Seitz was talking about, you know, the difference, you know, and why the three outcomes now, and how there's so much emphasis on launch angle and all that. And he said, guys aren't penalized for striking out. Guys are rewarded for slug, and that's all they're rewarded for, basically. And until that changes, why are hitters going to change? I mean, you're not penalized for striking out 150 times, and you're rewarded for hitting 30 bombs and for little else, or hitting high slugging percentage. You're not penalized for hitting 230.
Carlos Pena was the first guy I remember saying, screw it, and just being willing to hit 210 with 35, 40 homers.
Yeah, yeah. We laughed at Dave Kingman when I was a kid. Everybody thought Dave Kingman was some kind of a freak. And he's basically the game right now. Right now, this snapshot in time, he is so many sluggers. He is not much more extreme than a whole lot of sluggers out there right now. But at the time, when I was a kid, he was an absolute freak. What he did was like, you'd never want a team full of those guys. But he was fine to hit 40 home runs, you know, and strike out 150. He didn't even strike out 150, 200 times.
You ask any pitcher, you know, for me, the hardest at bats were guys like Martin Prado.
Yeah.
That you could make your pitch and they'll still hit a single. When you face a lineup full of guys just trying to hit home runs or trying to do damage, I know that if I make my pitch, it's going to be a ground ball to shortstop. Yeah. And then it just comes down to execution. Because the guys that adapt, or do a guy like Prado that would, you know, if I threw him a slider away, he's going the other way. If I try to pound him in, he might pull it. Those for me were always the toughest at bats. And I feel like just that, you know, from a pitching standpoint, nobody values singles. But as a pitcher, you give up a single and it's like, maybe I don't have it today. And now there's a hole on the right side. You know how it affects the next couple hitters? Yeah. I just don't feel like it's valued.
It's crazy. Yeah, the teams that win are still the teams that, and this was the goal as a hitter, your goal every year, to be ready to do damage, but be cautious enough to take the pitches you need to take. And that's the Dodgers, that was the Astros, that's been the Red Sox. You know, they're 3-2 every hitter in the lineup.
Oh, the Dodgers are 3-2.
Walk, walk, walk. Homer, walk. Base hit, walk.
Yep.
You know, two strikes, it's 0-2. Next thing you know, it's 3-2. Like, those are always the teams that win. And yet we don't see that emphasized and it's not easy. It's not an easy thing to be that. But that kind of goes back to what I was saying about my own career. I had a lot of more at bats in the beginning of my career that got to 3-2 than I did middle to later, and just being in that mindset of, man, I might, like Teixeira never swung 3-0, 40 home run hitter. I remember being in the dugout and Bobby being like, if this guy would just swing 3-0, he'd hit 10 more home runs a year. And it's like, but what does that
everybody swings 3-0?
What does that do to his? If he does do that, what does that do? What's the chain of reaction of that? You know, what might it create? Would it create 10 more homers? But it might.
Yeah, you get a 3-0 pop up as a pitcher.
25 fewer walks. Gift. He had a huge walk. He had a huge OBP.
So anyway,
Kingman. I'm looking at Dave Kingman, by the way, because he was considered the, you know, Adam Dunn of his dime, like the first forerunner of that. The dude never struck out 160 times in his career, and he led the league in strikeouts like 3 out of 4 years, 131, 105, 156. This was like 1979 to 82. Last 8 years of his career, from 79 to 86, averaged 30 homers, and at a time when 30 homers was like 45 today.
Yeah.
Averaged 106 strikeouts, and he was considered like a whiff king.
That's funny, isn't it?
Isn't that funny?
That's funny.
Game's just totally changed, man.
I know.
So, hey, I was going to ask you real quick before we get running out of time here. Austin Riley, start of the year, he hit in his first 15 games, hit 182 with a 456 OPS. And we were playing the Yankees up in New York. And I remember Bo asked Snit, how long can you stick with Austin Riley? He's one of those guys you just got to be patient with, you know? And Snit was like, I really don't have a choice to be patient with. You got to be patient with these young guys. It's not like we have there's an option. You have to be. And then he caught fire right then. That's when he caught fire. But it reminded me of the year that, you know, that you had when you first came up. It was, you know, you went 0 for whatever. And Bobby was just stubborn as hell and said, I'm staying with him. And then you car fire. But Austin Riley, even with his 0-for-17 that he just went through before yesterday, his last 47 games, this guy has hit his last 47 games, he's hit 329, 10 doubles, 12 homers, 412 OBP, 506 slugging, 1,017 OPS. Yep. Last 47 games. Yep. In that same span, since April 18th, Acuna has hit 224, 11 homers, 827 OPS in 44 games. Tells you how hot he was early. Freddie Freeman has hit 244, 810 OPS, 11 homers in 47 games. Ozzie Albies, 284, 882 OPS, 16 doubles, 4 triples, 7 homers in 47 games. So, I mean, all this guy's under 900, 827, 810, 882 OPS. Riley's over 1,000. Just, I mean, it's like.
Something clicked.
He's carried the offense. I mean, Acuna was so hot early that he's still got huge numbers. He's still, you know, MVP caliber numbers. But, I mean, the guy that's carried the offense the last 45 games is Riley.
Here's another way the game's changed, and it blows my mind when I see those OPS numbers. Is same thing. Teixeira being on the team, we had him in spring training the next year in 08. And just OPS came up, and that was the first time I think I even really ever had a conversation about OPS. And he said,
"Yeah,
he said anything over like 800 is good. He said anything over 900 is all star. Anything up over 950 is like Hall of Fame. He didn't even mention 1,000.
Right.
And then so Murph, you look at Daniel Murphy, and he went through that 2015 that monster stretch in the playoffs, and he got hot there at the end, but up until. Maybe when he went to Washington. I don't even think because that was his free agent. Yeah. So the next year, he had never had a month that he had an 800 above 800 OPS.
Wow.
Never one month in his whole career.
That's amazing.
At that point, it was 7 years deep. Never had one month of having an OPS over. And that's where it's like, okay, I get now a little bit of the mentality of what these guys are doing because you're looking at, you know, how much they do get on base. So they still are drawing some walks, they are striking out. And then they're driving the ball. And so is it really worse? I think that the fact that when you need to shorten up and you really need to move a runner 90 feet, we're just not seeing it.
Right. It's not valued.
Absolutely. That's
as far as the OPS goes, it's crazy how many guys are up. Back in the day, it was Manny Ramirez, Alex Rodriguez, and then one other dude would have 1,000 OPS.
Right. That's it.
That was it. You know, and now it's – and 900 was good. 800 was good. If you had an OPS over 800, I look at, like, my best season ever was – my OPS was not 900. It was a good 800, 850, 800, I don't know what it was, but it wasn't 900.
And now it's like, 800.
I was on point that year. Yeah. You know, and I'm like, dude, like, these guys put me to shame now. Like, I mean, that's just tells you, like, how it's changed.
Yeah.
These guys are really good. It's just – just please, for the life, like when you need to do it, just let's try not to strike out one time.
The get them over and get them in has just died, man. It's just like you might. The only time you even hear it is during batting practice. Get them over, get them in, but they don't do it during the game.
They're still doing it,
but they don't do it during the game though. They do it during batting practice.
Yep.
Yeah, that's the main thing I see that Kelly was talking about. It's just those big at bats when you need it, and then you see a guy.
Yeah,
strike out, you know, runner on second, full swing.
Does it drive you crazy when a team gets one or two guys? When a team gets two guys on with none out in an inning, I see this all the time. I mean, sorry, but the Braves do it a lot. Get two guys on, none out, and nobody scores. You get a strikeout, pop up, roll over. I mean, it's like just a different game than it used to be. And they're a good team, you know, right? Ground they're playing great, but they're still good. But they're not even a bad team, and they're doing that.
Yeah, and now coaching my kids, it's what's funny from a coaching perspective. Managing coaching is like those situations.
You're trying to tell them
so important, and as a player, sometimes it's just like you know, it's hard when you're the hitter. There's so many factors of what you're trying to accomplish. Like you're trying to stay within yourself to just even compete in this at bat. So to go up there and act like it's so easy to drop a bunt or you know, move a guy, like you it's like you're trying to stay within yourself and make that happen. And so, you know, as a coach, you're like, it's not that hard. Come on. Like, why can we not get that guy in from third, infield back?
That's what I was asking you, you know, because the stuff's nasty. And
it is hard. Size of chipper, both said. This
thing is really hard because the pitchers are pitching to the defense.
Right.
Yeah.
Because like I heard Glavine say just the other day on the Braves broadcast, he said for them, the defense played for the pitcher. So, you know, the scouting meetings before every series was, here's who we got. You know, and then let's say it's Glavine and he's change up and, you know, outside corner. So now you got, you know, the defense, the outfield going this way, you know, the infield going this way, and he stays out there. And you're hoping for weak pull ground balls and you're hoping for flare pop up or whatever, weak contact, you know, and so your defense is set up for him. Now, you know, that guy, he's 90% pull. So we're shifting him.
Right.
Pitching him in. Yeah.
I wonder what they would do with Andrew Jones, if they would do anything different to him, because Andrew, you know, was the ridiculous innate ability to – I mean, he had three Hall of Famers pitching, granted, but, I mean, there's video of Andrew taking that first step before the ball's hit. I mean, he
he knew what the pitcher was doing.
Right, yeah. And the pitcher was not going to miss. His pitchers were not going to miss either.
Oh, yeah. No, Andrew was such a freak. That guy needs to be in the Hall of Fame.
I agree.
And why is anybody wearing this guy's number for the Braves? It's driving me nuts.
I agree with that too.
I don't really care, but like at the same time, I'm like, that's not right.
It took them a while just to put him in their Hall of Fame. Yeah, but they didn't retire his jersey. The only jersey they've retired of a non-Hall of Famer is Murph.
Yeah, Andrew deserves it.
I agree. 10 straight gold gloves and 450 home runs. I mean, come on. You're going to tell me his batting average wasn't high enough or whatever?
Yeah.
He's a Hall of Famer, man. He's the greatest center fielder I've ever seen.
If you could say that, game 26 right
years. I've covered the game 26 years. He's the greatest I've ever seen. Hands down.
Yeah.
Devon White at his peak was close defensively. Close. But he wasn't Andrew Jones.
Yeah.
At his peak. And Devon didn't do it for half as long as Andrew did at his peak. You know, Willie Mays, guys who saw Willie Mays. And Willie Mays told Andrew, you're the best I've ever seen. TP was standing there talking to AJ, to Andrew in San Francisco, and Willie Mays walked over and told him, said, son, kid, you're the best I've ever seen. Play center field.
That should be enough.
Come on. Right there. That's like, just put him in the hall. We don't vote. Willie Mays said he's the best he's ever seen.
Andrew, unanimous Hall of Famer, one vote.
That's all it takes. Willie Mays.
Yeah.
By the way, to you, what you were saying about the Braves as far as pitching, you're right. I mean, the offense is still there, the raw numbers. Now, they piled up some stats, and some, it's a little skewed because they piled up some stats and some big routes. But they're third in the NL in scoring right now behind only the Reds and the Dodgers, third in OPS behind those two teams, and they lead the NL in home runs with 95. But they're 11th in the league in ERA at 434, which you don't usually see from the Braves. They're ahead of only the Pirates, Reds, Rockies, and D-backs in ERA. And – they've allowed 78 homers, which is tied for fourth most in the NL, and they don't play in a hitter-friendly ballpark. It's a fair ballpark. They've issued 219 walks, sixth highest in the NL, and here's where it really gets ugly. The starters are ninth in the NL with a 4.10 ERA. The Braves relievers are 13th in the league with a 4.77 ERA. They're better than only the Rockies and the Reds, and we know those two teams have some disadvantages.
Yeah.
So that's... Yeah. That's killing them. I mean, it's killing them. We've seen that. We saw the lack of bullpen depth. They've got some horses, but it's like three of them instead of six like they had last year.
Yeah. Missing Soroka is not good either, but, you know, you can't do anything about injuries sometimes. But that's that's your number one. It's the same thing as having, okay, when is Freddie coming up in the batting order? Okay, every fifth day, when is Soroka going to pitch?
Right.
Things like that. Game changers for your squad. I mean, it's... And it puts everybody in their place.
Right.
Yeah.
That's what I always said about Chipper. Chipper's in the three hole versus not playing. Now who's hitting third?
Yeah. Yeah. Like,
you know, who's hitting and then who's hitting wherever he was hitting. You know, it's just the trickle down. So it's a tough one. But I don't know. They're still good enough and the division's still weak enough and you know, they're all in that same they should be good, but they definitely have to have what all the good teams have is that run. And that's where Teixeira said, 100 games in, who makes the run for the last 60? And that's, you know.
They have had 3-4 game losing streak, but they haven't had put together a good winning streak yet. One of those win 9 out of 10, 17 out of 20. They haven't done anything like that yet, close to that yet. And it's hard when you're not getting a bunch of guys clicking at once, which they've seen, done a little better at that lately. And I think Chris Martin, if they can keep him upright and healthy, makes a huge addition to that bullpen. They're different with him in there. He's so good, but you just got to keep him healthy. You can't overwork that guy or he gets hurt.
Yep. So. Yep.
Anyway, well, man, listen, it's been great having you, dude. It's great hearing your perspective on all this stuff. It's I can never tire of hearing your stories. It's great to hear
from
the guys.
Don't get tired of these tan lines either. I know you're going to miss these.
Those are beauties, man. Those are beauties. You kept them. All right.
Appreciate y'all, man.
Yeah, thanks for coming on, Keller.
Anytime. Good talking to y'all.
Good luck to the kids and youth in East Cobb baseball.
Yep, raising the next wave of mediocre baseball players like their dad.
Yeah, mediocre. All right. Thanks a lot to Kelly for joining us here, and I hope you guys stuck around till the end and give us a good thumbs up and all that. 755 is real. We'll be back again later in the week.